My guest today on Takes on the World, Colleen Rowley, is a former FBI agent and whistleblower and was a Democratic Farmer Labor Party's candidate for Congress in Minnesota's 2nd Congressional District in the 2006 congressional elections. For her outspoken critique of the FBI's mishandling of information prior to the 9/11 attacks, Rowley was jointly titled the Time Person of the Year in 2002 with Sharon Watkins and Cynthia Cooper. She has also testified in front of the Senate and for the 9/11 Commission about, quote, the FBI's internal organization and mishandling of information related to the September 11, 2001 attacks. Since then, Rowley is a vocal critic of the U.S. foreign policy, the influence upon that policy by the pro-Israel lobby, and this country's ongoing military adventures. It's my great pleasure to welcome Colleen Rowley to Takes on the World. Hello, Colleen.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you with us. I've been following your career for a long time, and I've planned to get you on and finally did. Well, anyway, here we are, almost 13 years after 9/11, seeing U.S. troops once again landing in Iraq after thoroughly destroying that country and no end in sight for the latest commitment. Well, you've been observing and writing about this situation from the beginning. What's your take on what we're seeing here?
What are we seeing here? The 13 years into what they want to be a perpetual, endless war. McCain said 100 years, a war of 100 years. So I don't know. The public needs to get active. I think that's part of the answer. And there are reasons why they have become less and less, concerned about the situation, even though there have been some peaks where people have been concerned. And when they had the plan to bomb Syria, there were a number of people that did speak out. There was a little bit of people in the street when they called for the bombing of Syria. But in any event, right now, that's the issue. People are become not only war weary, but they become weary of the whole situation. And we see this on television where people say the polls. So 80-some percent, I think it's at least 80, maybe even above 80% of the public who is against the wars and sending troops and military dollars abroad. There's a large majority against it. And yet nothing seems able to stop this machine, mostly fueled by neocons and military-industrial complex, pushing for this endless perpetual war. And as soon as one enemy kind of becomes stale, they get a new one. We are almost on the doorstep of having a World War III with Russia a month ago. Hopefully that's kind of calmed down. Who knows? But it's just endless. And this group of neocons, pro-Israel neocons, really has no foot in reality. I think the split is no longer between liberal or conservative or progressives or Tea Party. It's not obviously between the Republicans and the Democrats. The split is between these crazy idealists, utopian idealists that think the United States can control and basically have a new world order where the United States like dictates the world. Those are utopian idealists, if you want to give them a good term, and then people who are realists, who have a foot in reality and say, this isn't possible. I mean, what you're asking for here is for the United States to literally to have regime change around the world and control the world. So I'm not quite sure how this is all going to end up. It's very frightening to be a part of witnessing and frustrating, of course, as well, because you don't see that you can have any impact in changing it. We protest, we do everything. And I guess that's a little pessimistic to say we can't have any impact, because obviously I think we did deter that bombing plan on Syria last fall. So there still is hope that things right now, the new war that they look like they're ginning up on Iraq and Syria. Obama himself is coming here tomorrow. Obama is going to be here for 2 days in the Twin Cities. And Pelosi. Pelosi and Obama are going to be at a big money fundraiser Thursday night. And then they're also giving quote-unquote town halls, but the town halls are by invitation only. And then Obama's going to give a speech in one of our big parks. And again, you have to get tickets to this ahead of time. But this one is open to the public as long as you get a ticket on the economy. So there's like a 3 or 4 events that are going to be going on over the next 2 days. And we're going to try to protest it, as many of these as we can. I shouldn't say protest, but we're going to try to hold banners up that say no war, no new war on Iraq. One of my favorite ones is don't ever believe God chose the U.S. to be policeman of the world. And people think of that as maybe some libertarian, but no, that was Martin Luther King that said that a long time ago. So anyways, I'm making banners right now to try to message Obama, Pelosi, and all these other powerful, wealthy people who are running the country.
Well, that sounds great. It reminds me back in 1991, a friend of mine who had a Chinese junk and a large sale came to my place, and he said, this is before the first war in Iraq, he said, I have this large sale, and I want to make it into a banner. What should be the slogan? And I said, no war for Israel. And I've used it since. You are one of the very few people who talk about the Project New American Century, the Foreign Policy Initiative, its successor, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, whose experts, quote unquote, are quoted all the time in the New York Times, NPR, with no reference to where they are coming from and how these organizations are formed and what part of the network. You are the only one, or one of the very few, who seems to be aware of the role that the neocons and the Israel lobby have played in producing the war in Iraq, pushing us to a war in Iran, pushing us to bomb Syria, and also provoking Russia with the coup against the elected government in the Ukraine. Perhaps you could elaborate on that. I congratulate you for all that.
I don't think I'm the only one, but because there are a few people. And recently Robert Perry of Consortium News has been doing a good job, yeoman's work, in writing constantly about how the neocons are the ones pushing this. But yes, if you look at these faces, these are the same faces that push for war on Iraq. And then if you back up, of course, that's correct. They wrote, they founded the Project for the New American Century. Robert Kagan was the co-founder, I think, along with William Kristol and others. And you look at the names who signed that Project for the New American Century, and now it's changed names to Foreign Policy Initiative, I believe. It's just like Blackwater. It had to change its name because, you know, it got a little bad reputation with the old name, so they changed the name. Same people. The same people now are on the Sunday news shows constantly shilling for more war. So if you don't understand that that's what this is about, almost none of that group, all these Potterets, and they're almost incestuous because they're family members, and then they got wives, like Robert Kagan's wife is Victoria Nuland, and Frederick Kagan's wife is Kim someone. Isn't she the head of the American Enterprise Institute? I mean, yeah. But they all got their tentacles, and so their wives and their fathers and their brothers, and they all go back a long time. They all know each other, and they've got more than one think tank. So oftentimes I use a shorthand or a shortcut, and I say American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, APAC. And I just use that as a shortcut, well knowing that that's just one of the umbrella groups. But there's all these other pro-Israel foreign policy think tanks. I think the YNAP, which I would have even a hard time saying what it all stands for, but I think it's actually secretly a spinoff of APAC. APAC actually formed it.
In 1985,
Yeah, they have their meetings, and they say, well, you know, we'll set up another front group. Of course, if you realize I was an FBI agent, and this is exactly what fraudsters do. Fraudsters set up new companies, and they set up shell companies. And you do that to hide what you're doing. And so all of these, instead, you know, if you think about it, if you were in the business, in a legitimate business of making money not even so much making money, but offering a service to the public that actually was intended to last for decades, and you wanted your business and your company to go on, you wouldn't change your name. You wouldn't do what all this pro-Israel neocon group is doing, because they're trying to hide what they're doing. They're not trying to necessarily brand themselves. They want to use their expertise, so-called expertise, to fool the media that they're experts so that they can get on TV shows and then twist and warp U.S. foreign policy. You know, a lot of people I read say, how can we be listening to these same warmongers that led us into the foolhardy the war on Iraq, which was proven completely disastrous. You know, we were going to bring democracy. It completely backfired. Even from a strategic standpoint, it empowered or helped get Iran stronger. So people say it was a complete mistake. You get the same people who lied us into war in Iraq are the same ones now saying that we've got to attack the group in Iraq again. Same people. Why would you ever listen to them? And almost none of them have any real military experience. The Max Boots and the Frederick Kagan, who claims Robert Kagan, they claim that they are military historians, that they use that term military. Well, none of them have military experience. They're complete chicken hawks. And so, you know, Cheney and Rove, 11 draft deferments between the two of them, and people listening to them as if they're experts on the military when they actually refused to even serve in the military during the Vietnam War. It's pretty incredible how they can bamboozle a country this way, but they are masters of propaganda and deceit. I would say that people underestimate many people say, oh, the neocons, that was last year, they're over with. And I said, no, that's not true at all. They are masters of deceit, and this propaganda works really well. It worked, of course, during the Bush era. It worked quite well on the Republican base. Now they flipped it around, and the same humanitarian imperialists more or less took over under Obama. But it's the same propaganda about, you know, the United States has to take over this policeman of the world job. No one else will do it. The world needs democracy. We have to protect, the people in Benghazi. These are all lies, by the way. Absolutely. You have to. And there's just a handful of people explaining, like Robert Perry, why these are lies. And, you know, by using facts, because the neocons are not fact-based. They are masters of propaganda, but they are not at all fact-based.
Actually, I'm glad you mentioned Robert Perry, because I actually have interviewed him just about a month ago on the subject. So he is one of those who is writing for Consortium News on the subject. But in generally, what would be considered the alternative media doesn't talk about the neocons. It didn't talk about PNAC when it existed. It never mentions the Foreign Policy Initiative. And the other, its sister organization called the Foundations for Defensive Democracy and the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs. And there's one other that I've never mentioned on the air, but just after the Syrian opposition began going into the streets, the Washington Institute started something called the FIKRA Forum, in which they have brought in Arab intellectuals from all over the Arab world to discuss the Middle East and Syria. But not mentioning who they were, who is the organization they were fronting for. And then you go to the Washington Institute site, and there you find it. So they are really so heavily involved, and yet, as you say, the public doesn't know about it, and they haven't been held accountable.
Yeah. You know, I will just kind of refine slightly. Under the Bush administration, the alternative media, once they learned of the Project for the New American Century, there were many articles, and they would always pull that line out of the one resolution that was signed that said, you know, this all sounds great, except we're going to need a new Pearl Harbor. So there were quite a few articles back under the Bush administration then saying, oh, look, they actually talked about 9/11 being a pretext. And sure enough, 9/11 happens. In fact, the people that are the conspiracists that think that there weren't 19 hijackers, and they don't even think planes flew, and some of them think there were bombs in the World Trade Center, et cetera, then they saw that and said, well, look, this was all planned. And when you read that stuff, sure enough, it almost looks like a blueprint. It looks like a plan. And there was quite a bit of talk under the Bush administration. However, once Obama takes over, then it completely flip-flops. And that's exactly probably why they changed the name. They realized that this partisanship on the part of the American public would make so that the Obama loyalists are not going to want to have anything that links him to Bush. They're going to make it seem like he's new and different and he's changed and reformed, etc. And so that's probably why they changed their name, because they realized, well, we did get a little tarnished with that old name, and people do know that we called for a new Pearl Harbor, etc. And now we'll change the name, and nobody will mention it. And you're absolutely right. I don't even hear mention. When Crystal goes on, maybe they do mention Crystal's on almost every Sunday. He's one of the main pundits sitting there. And his father was, of course, founder of the neocons, Irving Crystal. And when you see him introduced, you never hear him it mentioned that he was part of the old PNAC and that he's got a new one and that he's connected with the Kagans, et cetera. He never gets introduced that way. So, yes, it's kept very quiet. I think a lot of it is probably due to the fact that people are so worried about saying the improper words on offending Israel. You know, when I ran for Congress, I have some stories about AIPAC. We have a Minnesota AIPAC group here that's pretty active. And when I ran, initially, there's a big dinner that the state AIPAC has, and they called me, and probably was in the first week, you know, that I announced my, because I ran for 18 months. I announced that I was going to run for Congress 18 months ahead of time. So I had been invited to meet with them and go to their dinner right off the bat. But then Cindy Sheehan's camp outside of Bush's ranch in August of 2005 occurred, and I went to that encampment. I think I was probably the only congressional candidate who went to Cindy Sheehan's camp. Well, then all of a sudden that invitation just faded away. And it's a long story, but eventually somebody makes calls and gets me invited back for a so-called interview. The interview was with another group that is closely aligned with the AIPAC group called the Jewish Community Relations Committee, JCRC. And that JCRC, there's actually been some leaks about it and stuff. Well, they're completely joined at the hips. There's even officials that have dual roles here in our JCRC and the Minnesota AIPAC. And they set up this interview that was a complete fraud thing that had the incumbent's neighbor, I assume she was a Jewish neighbor, and then afterwards she went out on this networking whisper campaign, calling me anti-Semitic, etc. So this was all set up, though, ahead of time. And basically all I said in this interview was that I thought that the Mideast, we would better served to have peace in the Mideast rather than these continuous wars. And I had this whole position written up that I was for peace in the Middle East. Well, they consider that to be anti-Semitic. And then she went out on emails and stuff, and somebody that was a volunteer in my campaign, a Jewish person who was a volunteer, came back and said, Colleen, I just heard you're anti-Semitic. I just read this. You know, so that's how I realized what's going on. Well, I mean, you talk about controlling, unbelievable. Every candidate that runs for an office is going to go through this. If you have no traction at all, if you have no ability to win, then they just leave you alone. But if you're having any chance of winning, you're going to have this treatment with a kind of a whisper campaign. Well, I think the politicians, obviously, this has an impact on them. Very few politicians are willing to call a spade a spade and say what's going on here. And certainly the neocons and this pro-Israel idea that we're going to be in a perpetual war is basically we've just plagiarized that from Israel. Israel says it's in a perpetual war with all of its neighbors. And the police state type stuff, the use of torture, this ubiquitous surveillance, cameras everywhere. In Israel, they put cameras all along the wall and stuff. Where are those ideas coming from? There are actually consultants that come from Israel and talk to police departments and tell them to buy these cameras and tell them to do these types of things and how to get confessions and all these. And I remember Alan Dershowitz was one of the big incentives then for the United States to quote unquote go to the dark side. He wrote a series of op-eds right after 9/11 saying, about taking the gloves off and how they do it in Israel so that it's just perfectly done. He wrote three different op-eds. Well, that was the same time that the United States set up Guantanamo and began this whole series of what they euphemistically termed harsh interrogation tactics, but were actually torture. Well, that all was glommed to a great extent from Israelis.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned the pressure on politicians. The wonderful, otherwise wonderful Elizabeth Warren, who many people want to have run for president, is tightly in AIPAC's pocket. When she was running for Senate, they obviously went to her and asked her for a statement of support for Israel, and it appears she told them, "You write it, and I'll put it on my website," which she did. And it could have been written by any Israeli propagandist. This totally gives Israel carte blanche to do what it has to do. And she's also signed every letter to the president that AIPAC writes these letters and gets members of Congress to sign them. And that's a sad commentary on the influence they have over the U.S. political process. And then we have these JCRCs are all over the United States, very active, working with AIPAC, working with the Anti-Defamation League. It's a network that really is unstoppable because people are afraid to speak about it because they're afraid of being called anti-Semitic. And it's much easier to blame everything on big bad Washington. But you might comment on the fact that until George W. Bush became president, when the first George Bush was president, he did not want an enduring war in Iraq. He did not want to depose Saddam because he's publicly said he did not want to destabilize the Middle East, and nor did Brent Scowcroft, his national security advisor, or Secretary of State Jim Baker. And the neocons turned on him because he left Saddam in power. So one of the points that I see happening is there are a lot of people who are against the war, but they see the U.S., that the neocon policy is being conflated with U.S. policy, not ready to acknowledge the influence that the neocons have had on U.S. policy since George W. Bush became elected, and that Obama seems to be a weak instrument in their hands.
Yes, I think that's all correct. You know, going back to Elizabeth Warren and the Bush father, there's the thought that if you don't play ball with AIPAC, and I was told this by several seasoned, the successful politicians. I was told, I actually had four meetings with Rahm Emanuel, and I don't remember talking specifically about this with Rahm Emanuel, but he was all about money. That's all he cared about. And he wasn't totally wrong. Money is very, very important. I mean, we've had the latest example of the Tea Party candidate beating Cantor. So that's been very much the exception, where a guy who had far less money beat the incumbent. But normally, you know, you can almost go by the dollar amount. I mean, if you raise a couple hundred thousand dollars more, you are almost certain to win. I mean, because the money was so important. But where does that money come from? So most of these seasoned politicians will tell you, you got to. I mean, so what Elizabeth Warren is saying in her head is she may not like all of the policies of AIPAC, but she's been told, every candidate is told in the first week, that if you don't get this big money, it's over. You can't possibly win. And so you tell yourself, I'll sign this right now, and I'll put this on my... But then when I get in, because I've got to... It's an ends justify the means. I've got to win in order to be able to have the power to do anything. And so I'll win first, and then somehow I'll come to grips with the policies, and maybe I will go against AIPAC at some point. That's what I think all good people, and it's so insidious and so seductive for even good people that want to, you know, be have the public interest in mind instead of just a special interest group like AIPAC and the Israeli interest. But they tell themselves they have to do this to get the big money in order. And this is the it's a carrot and stick. They can do, you know, campaigns like I mentioned, the Whisper campaign and whatever, blacklisting people. But they also mostly use carrot. And especially at the early stage, it's just that you can't raise any big money without AIPAC being behind it. And even in Minnesota, I guess they say Jewish are the second largest minority or something, and both of our, I mean, we've had a lot of senators that have been Jewish, not necessarily, you know, in AIPAC's pocket, like Wellstone, I don't believe, was in AIPAC's pocket exactly, but Franken is terribly pro-war, and, you know, he's never gone against AIPAC, and we had a Rudy, forget his name now, but we just had a whole bunch. And so in our state, it's even in Minnesota and out in the middle of nowhere, you know, in the middle of the country, and you wouldn't think that this crowd would have such power. They do. And it's largely the power of the purse. And then there's other things, too, which is that the propaganda and this great access to media, which is another. So if they do want to start marginalizing you and calling you names, you see what they did with Ron Paul and Cynthia McKinney, and there's a whole bunch of them that if they do decide that you really pose a problem. I keep waiting for Rand Paul now to fall to get the ire of the AIPAC group, and he might. You know, they're probably being very cautious because if he doesn't get the type of traction, Ron Paul never really got, you know, full traction. He was looking kind of, you know, if you were an AIPAC, he was looking scary for a while, but he, you know, they were being cautious. And I think if that happens, then they launch the other side of this, which is to, you know, blacklist you and start besmirching you on all of the media, calling you racist and anti-Semitic and all the rest. So that's how it kind of works. It's very powerful. And politicians, by and large, you know, even the so-called progressives in Minnesota, besides Franken, who was on Air America and claimed to be progressive, and most people thought he was. Well, now he's been pro-war on every issue. But besides him, there was Keith Ellison. And Keith Ellison is a representative of Minneapolis, very liberal district. He was always anti-war. He even stood on the Capitol steps when I and another state senator came back from Cindy Sheehan's camp, and we gave speeches against the Iraq war, and there was the senator, myself, and the senator, by the way, whose son was killed in Iraq, myself and this Keith Ellison, this before he became a representative, and he was an anti-war firebrand. So you know, fast forward a few years, and he is the co-chair of the Progressive Caucus, goes out trying to lead the United States to bomb Syria. He wrote the first op-ed about we have to bomb Syria. I mean, here he so that's a flip-flop of 180 degrees.
I didn't know that.
You know, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, he was along with Franken. Franken did too. Both of them were leading, trying to push Obama to bomb Syria. And, you know, people excuse him. The progressives, who are, of course, very partisan, excuse Keith Ellison. They'll say, oh, there's a lot of Syrians, Americans in his district. That's not true at all. There's a handful of Syrian Americans who want to topple Assad, but that, you know, you certainly wouldn't go with that handful as opposed to the whole district of mostly it's inner city Minneapolis and mostly liberal district. Anyway, he does this. So we kind of bird dog him to one of his fundraisers that I knew about, and the person even at the fundraiser was anti-war. And so we were outside right on the sidewalk next to where this was occurring, saying, don't bomb Syria. And we forced him to give a speech about his position on trying to humanitarian war. Of course, he tries to claim that he's trying to protect the Syrians, et cetera. And he said, but I still believe America is a force for good in the world, et cetera. Well, eventually we kind of catcalled him, and, you know, and we even raised our hands. And because we were in this environment where the person holding the fundraiser allowed us to speak. And so, I mean, it really ruined his day, I think, having us there. Well, on his way out then, he shoots me a look, you know, because I had been a candidate with him. I was the only candidate who defended him when they tried to go against him being a Muslim in the state. Even our Democratic candidates were afraid of being linked to Keith Ellison because he was a Muslim at the time in 2006. And I was the only one who even defended him back then. But anyways, in going out, he shoots me this look. And I said, Keith, what happened? You stood on the Capitol steps with me, and you were against war. And he shot me a look. He goes, I was never against war. And I went, oh, my gosh. I mean, this is how this works. And, of course, AIPAC is very, very powerful in Minneapolis. And he's had to kowtow to a lot of different big-money donors in that district. And over, what, 6-7 years now, he's turned. I notice he did vote in the recent vote where Barbara Lee tried to get them to vote that Congress does not authorize Obama to start the Iraq War. Keith Ellison did vote with Barbara Lee against starting the Iraq War again. But no, when it came to Syria, somehow he was for that.
I want to ask you one question, really, 9/11. Here we are 13 years after 9/11. There are 5 men prisoners in Guantanamo who have been charged with being involved in 9/11, yet none of them have been brought to trial. What does that tell us?
That just shows you that these unlawful, because indefinite detention, that's what Guantanamo was carved out to be in the first place. Well, the black sites were, most of these 5 were all in black sites first. So secret, illegal, black sites, kidnapped from places. And, of course, they were people that were, later, I think there is quite a bit of evidence of the 5 you're talking about, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Ramzi bin al-Shib, et cetera. So there is quite a bit of evidence against them, but a number of people were kidnapped and held in black sites, et cetera, that were completely innocent as well, because they just aren't that careful with their accuracy and their facts. But you see that these tactics of going, not following the law, not adhering to these universal principles that go all the way back to the Magna Carta, that you have to have some level of evidence in order to, in charging people and then giving them their day in court, airing the evidence, allowing a jury to assess it. That's been around. These things have been around for hundreds of years. Well, 9/11 happens and people say, we don't have to worry about that old laws anymore. We're above it. We're going to be the policemen. Same, the drone memo is a perfect example of that as well. It's hard to know even where to start, but it's just saying we can kill anyone that a small executive branch determines to put on a list can be killed, and we'll call it war. I mean, this was completely unlawful, and yet because they get a high-level person who now has become a First Circuit judge to sign off on that, most people in the United States, most columnists say, oh, it's legal. He became a First Circuit judge. Torture is legal because the guy, Bob Bybee, who signed off on that in the Department of Justice, he's a federal district judge. And if he signed off on the memos that say you can torture people, you can waterboard, you can sleep deprive, all these things that are definitely torture, it's pretty incredible. It's Orwellian that these unlawful actions that the majority of Americans have bought into that, thinking, no, it's fine and dandy. There's nothing wrong with this. And it's all going to catch up with the United States. I fear that, for instance, when other countries develop drones and you've told the world that it's not illegal to have you can bomb any place in the world as long as you say that person's there, and we say it's unfeasible to capture them, and we say there's evidence all in secret. Well, what if every other country starts following that? What if other countries started secretly kidnapping Americans and holding them in black sites and torturing them and waterboarding. If any of these things become reciprocal, the United States is going to have a fit. Recently with the Crimea in Ukraine, Kerry gave a speech saying, I don't know how any country could invade a smaller, weaker nation. And everybody says, you hypocrite. You know, the United States did that to Iraq. And now you're trying to say that Russia can't do this with Crimea. The thing is, all international law has is reciprocity. There is no policeman of the world. There never has been. The only enforcement mechanism in the world is reciprocity, is that eventually when other countries do the same things that the precedents that the United States is setting now as an empire, thinking it's above the law, then everybody will say, no, we can't have it. We've got to have some principles. We can't be allowing torture all over the world. We can't be allowing wars of aggression, etc. It's just very uncomfortable right now to be in this situation because this is slowly happening, this kind of blowback and karma or reap what you sow, whatever you want to call it. It's slowly happening. People deny it. Of course, you know, the people who are part and parcel of this, you know, claim that the United States is still going to go strong, still going to continue on with this empire and be above the law. I think it won't last forever. I just don't know exactly how long it will last.
Colleen, we have come to the end of a very enlightening hour. We had a number of people wanted to call, but I love what you were saying, and so I'm sorry, callers, but we'll have to have you again. Very enlightening program, enlightening hour for our listeners. Colleen Rowley, thank you so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World.
Yep, thank you for having me.
And keep on keeping on, as they say.
Yes, we will.
Take care.